Welcome back to another Postmortem Files episode. Before we actually start, thank you guys for making the last episode, actually the first episode, to be the most listened to episode of this podcast. It is almost 200 plays right now. Currently it is actually at 81, but it is edging to this podcast's first ever 100 listens on an episode. So I want to thank you guys for that. And by the way, I know that I say this a lot too. You want to help out any episode on this podcast, and you just don't ever know when we publish a new episode. For one, go check out our Facebook page, After Dark Coast to Coast Killers. Right now, we don't have a blog post. It is probably still up. We just don't use it right now. You know, we're in the middle of everything. You know, my job, you know, this podcast and life, so I haven't been able to do the blog right now. But go check out our Facebook page, After Dark Coast to Coast Killers. And if you haven't actually considered being notified, you can go anywhere you listen to any podcast, not just ours, but any podcast, and get notified. Even on Spotify, it's just so easy. And no, we are not sponsored by Spotify. I really wish we were. But, you know, on Spotify, it's just so easy. Everywhere is so easy. You just hit follow, and it should say, "Do you want notifications?" Hit yes, because then you won't miss an episode ever. Anyhow, let's get into this. This is going to be a viewer's discretion advice. It is a really gruesome case. No, it's a murder-suicide case. That's why. This is talking about, you know, a case that happened in 2018 called the Hart Family Murders. This happened in California, and this may not seem like, you know, it was even a suicide or even a murder. It just seems oddly fitting just to, you know, name it as a car crash and car crash gone wrong. But unfortunately, this wasn't the case. As with the last two episodes, we are going to go into why this is important, who these people are, so you can get the gist of it, you know, and we will jump into the actual stuff as well, like the postmortem files, if there is any, which there should be, but if we can find them, and the autopsy files, if we can find them too, and I'm pretty sure we can. Anyhow, let's go into the background. So, Jennifer Jean Hart and Sarah Margaret Hart were both from South Dakota. Jennifer originated from Huron, and Sarah from Big Stone County. I'm just throwing this out here. I did not know that they were actually from my state. As I was just going through what I needed to do, I just picked out random stuff. According to Jennifer Hart's father, she was not initially raised as a Lutheran, but was baptized as one. Both women were the eldest children of their families, and Jennifer had two siblings while Sarah had three. Jennifer Hart attended Huron High School. Sarah attended high school in Minnesota. Some sources described Ortonville, Minnesota, adjacent to Big Stone City, as Sarah Hart's hometown. The two women attended Northern State University. While Sarah initially attended University of Minnesota for one semester, then transferred. And then Jennifer started at Augustana University, but transferred to Northern State in 1999. Both women majored in elementary education. With Sarah focusing on special education, Jennifer did not graduate, while Sarah did in 2002. Jennifer Hart left the university at the same time Sarah graduated. Now, this actually does, to a certain extent, say a lot about them already. You know, they had the common interest. You know, besides them being actual lovers, you know, they had a lot of things in common. They wanted to specialize in children, you know, whether it's, you know, helping children or just educating them. You know, they pretty much were that close together. And to even say it was a murder-suicide case, instead of just, like I said, a car accident gone wrong, is beyond me. The women begin the relationship at the university. On Facebook, Jennifer stated that the women were initially, just not out there. They didn't become open about them, you know, being lesbians. And face ostracism once they publicly outed themselves, prompting their moves. They moved after South Dakota to Alexandria, Minnesota in 2004 and were subsequently residents of Westland, Oregon and an unincorporated area in Clark County, Washington, which is outside of the city limits of Woodland, and had six adopted children during their lives. The couple was living in Woodland at the time of the crime. In 2005, Sarah asked the local court to have her last name altered to match her parents. They went to Connecticut to be married in 2009, and then at the same time, same-sex marriage was not yet legal in every state. Initially, both women worked at a hamburger shop in Alexandria, and Jennifer worked miscellaneous jobs until she became a stay-home mom in 2006, while Sarah became the manager at the Herberger's, and later became a manager at Kohl's in Hazeldale, Washington. The Harts received funds from the state of Texas, covering their children. Almost 50% of the family income was made up of Texas incomes. Feel like any episode before we continue, feel like any episode and want to hear more, follow us right now. Get notifications. Tell everyone actually about us. We want this podcast out there. So without, you know, going much into this, let's go into the adoption part really fast. You know, once again, they adopted six children. Jennifer and Sarah Hart were foster parents to a 15-year-old girl. A week before their first three children were due to arrive, the Harts dropped the 15-year-old girl off at a therapist appointment, and that the therapist had been affirmed her that the Harts would not be coming back to get her, saying the Harts were not just good fit. But anyhow, the other children was Abigail, Hannah, and Marcus Hart, and they were adopted from Colorado County, Texas. A placement came on March 4th of 2006, but they were adopted in September of 2006. Then in June 2008, they adopted three additional children, Sierra, Devante, and Jeremiah. The birth spellings of their names were Devonta, Jeremiah, and Sierra. Don't know why that's actually really important in this article, but anyhow. Let's go to a little bit, I guess, about why some of these children, I guess, were adopted. According to the article, Devante and Jeremiah Sierra were born and originated from Houston. Their biological mother lost custody as she had substance abuse problems with crack cocaine. The children's biological parents had their parental rights canceled by a court in Harris County, Texas. In August 2006, they were given to Priscilla Sustine, the sister of the father Jeremiah and Sierra, and therefore not from a father's side, under the condition that they have no contact with their biological mother. Celestine wanted to care for all three children and keep them together, even though Devante was not her biological nephew. Eventually, Sherry, once again the biological mother, was allowed to babysit, which a caseworker did observe. The lawyer for Celestine stated that Celestine was suddenly informed that she needed to work another shift and had Sherry babysit. As a result, Celestine did lose custody. She did not have any record of criminal activity. Let's see. Let's go down a little bit. Prior to the murders, Devante was 12 years old when he came into the national spotlight when he was photographed crying as he embraced a police officer during a 2014 protest in Portland, resulting from the Ferguson unrest. And the image became known as a hug felt around the world. Jennifer was very active on social media and used Facebook to portray an image of a loving, happy family while sharing her thoughts as well on race, politics, and trips that the family went on. This helped mask some of the problems with the family. In 2013, one allegation of child abuse touched upon Jennifer Hart's use of Facebook, saying that, quote unquote, the kids' posts that and are made to look like one big happy family, but after the photo event, they go back to looking lifeless. Associates of the Harts referred to them as the Hart tribe. Now let's go actually more into the important stuff. I just wanted to give the background of the children, their situation, why some of them were adopted, and what can actually, or probably did kind of portray part of this murder-suicide case. So let's go into the abuse now. In Minnesota, while the family was living there in 2008, Anna Hart was seen with bruises on her left arm, and when a teacher had asked about it, she had said that she'd been hit by Jennifer by belt, or with a belt, I should say. Within months, all six children had been pulled out of the public school system for a year. In 2010, Abigail said that she had allergies on her back and stomach. The incident was supposedly over a penny. Abigail said she had found the penny, but Sarah and Jennifer did not believe her. According to Abigail, Jennifer held Abigail's head under cold water and hit her. When the authorities got involved, all children claimed that they had been spanked constantly and deprived of food. You know, spanking in South Dakota, since I do live in South Dakota, isn't actually a crime. It's not even actual abuse, according to South Dakota law. By the way that I remember it, a parent can hit their child with a belt, but cannot leave any bruises and slash or any marks on their child. Nor can they actually hit their child or, you know, spank their child with anything more than three times. Otherwise, if it goes past three times and each spanking and each belt mark leaves a mark, or there's any marks afterward, it is considered abuse and child Dave Schmidt in the state. No, I know in Minnesota. I don't know in Minnesota what their laws are, but I'm pretty sure a lot of Midwest states, including a lot of the South, is very similar with these type of laws. But like I said, that's what I know from South Dakota. I don't know anything about Minnesota or any of the other states. But on the other half, when we look at a kid being deprived, neglected, not being fed, that is against the law. It is actually, for people that don't know, child neglect. You're neglecting a child's needs to survive. Sarah, however, did take responsibility, instead of Jennifer, for their abuse. She pled guilty to assault, and instead of serving time in prison, she was just slapped on the wrist with community service for a year. Let's see. 1 year later, Hannah, once again, the same Hannah from 2008, reportedly told a school nurse that she had not eaten all day. Sarah claimed that Hannah was merely playing the food court and recommended that Hannah just be given water. Around this time, all six children were homeschooled from that point forward. Like I said, no. I'm not a parent, okay? I'm just going to throw that out there. But, you know, if the child's not eating all day and you're like, just give your child water. Water is not nutrition. Water does help a child or anyone survive. But after a month, the child dies. Even less. There was a case up in Sioux Falls years ago about this family just feeding, or was, I don't remember if they were feeding their child or not, but the child was eating just sugar. And he died in less than a month. He was just 7 years old. But anyhow, let's get back on this case. So, from Minnesota to Oregon in 2013, authorities in Oregon had begun their own investigation into the Hart family after being notified of the allegations from Minnesota. This investigation included separate interviews of everyone in the family, as well as people that knew the family personally. I'm pretty sure some of these investigations will include people that slightly knew the family, but two family friends said that the children were forced to raise hands before speaking, could not wish each other a happy birthday, and could not laugh at the dinner table. There were other reports that the children were poorly fed and looked small for their ages. And like you said, when we talk about small, we're not talking about, you know, it's just natural growth. When we're talking small, in this case, from the standpoint that I'm hearing it from and reading it from, it's probably due to the fact that they look small because they are being neglected. And it might not just be from lack of food. It may be from restless nights. It may be from the abuse. You know, it doesn't always have to stem from food, but it probably was because they were being neglected for days upon days without food. Let's see. One family friend reported that Jin had ordered pizza for the children, but each was only allowed to have a small slice. You know, that's not bad, but what comes after that is bad. Despite, you know, Jennifer ordering that pizza, when she discovered that the pizza was gone, she punished the children by not feeding them breakfast and forcing them to lie on their bed for 5 hours. I'm not sticking up for her at this part, but I was raised as, you know, a child, and pretty sure a lot of people were raised the same way, you know, and who cares if the pizza's gone? you know. But let's just say if something else happens, something, you know, that they deserve the consequences for. You know, being grounded or being punished in your room and not being able to do anything was actually really common. You know, definitely before I was born, it seemed really common as well. You know, that, and even to the point where some parents wouldn't even actually give their kids a meal, which I know does sound bad, but, or at least not have them come out of the room and then wait until everyone else is done eating type of thing. You know, and that's why I'm saying I'm not sticking up for Jin or Sarah in this case. You know, because Sarah does have a part in this for not stopping it if she was actually there. You know, but it seems like it's a common parent punishment. You know, like I said, even before I was born, it seemed really common from people that I've heard it from. Anyhow, friends of the family stated that the children acted scared to death of Jin, and they were, quote-unquote, trained like robots. Which, these family friends, whether they are the same people reporting or not, it kind of does seem like they have that ordinance of you do this or you get punished. You raise your hand before you speak or you get punished. If you say happy birthday to each other, you get punished. It seems like they actually are being trained to fit that certain way and a certain agenda of the parents. And it's wrong. It is entirely wrong. Children be children. Get used to it. However, the interviews of the children themselves revealed no new incidents of abuse, nor did they mention anything that happened in Minnesota. You know, that's a red flag, by the way. For anyone that doesn't understand why that's a red flag, I'm going to quickly explain it. It's because simple fact is these children are, once again, being coached. They're being, like the family friend said, trained to act a certain way. As I read, they didn't mention anything about Minnesota. A normal kid, if they wanted, or if they didn't fear their parents, they would have reported that. Their Jennifer's and Sarah's children would have promptly said, yes, these things did happen in Minnesota. They didn't. Their children would have been honest and said, we have been being abused, like these people are saying. We are being neglected, but they didn't. In short, their parents aren't being actual parents. They're being abusers. They're forcing their children to not get out of the situation. They're forcing their children to be like, hey, you don't say anything. Because if you do, you know what happens. And it lights a fear in their children. When Jen herself was interviewed, she claimed that any family problems were the results of others not being tolerant to two lesbian mothers with six African American children. In the end, the investigation could not conclude whether the Harts were guilty of anything or whether there was a safety threat. You know, I could go into that, but I'm not. For the simple fact that it's obvious the children were in danger. I don't know why, or I should say, I don't know if it were going to be, or if it was going to be different, or if it would have been different, I should say, if the children were white. You know, and I'm not saying the parents were racist, you know, but like I said, I'm not going to go much into this whole situation right here. But the responsibility in conclusion According to Justin Harmon of Glamour, co-hosted a podcast called Broken Hearts, stated in official Ask Me Anything, and quote unquote, this is what he said, like I alliterated before reading this, it seems Jin had more control over the situation, therefore more culpable, but neither is innocent. Silence is complicity. And to alliterate, it seems like the children were afraid of Jin. You know, it seems like Jin was the one that had full control over the house. Jin was the one that had full control over the children. Whether or not Jin had full control over Sarah is unknown. But as he did state, and I stated as well, Sarah needs to take this responsibility as well. If she knew about these kids being abused, she should have stepped in regardless and said, enough is enough, I'm leaving you, I'm taking our children with me, and there's nothing you can do anymore. But at the same time, we don't know much about Sarah because it seemed like she wasn't home very often. She was a manager at a store, two stores, I think. You know, what could have actually played a part with Sarah? Anyhow, let's go into the desk and then we're going to go into what we need to with the autopsies and all of that. On March 26, 2018, Jennifer and Sarah Hart murdered all six of their children. When Jennifer Hart drove the vehicle, a GMC Yukon XL sports utility vehicle, over a 100-foot cliff on California State Route 1 in Mendocino, I think, County, California, near Westport. The bodies of five of the children, Hannah, Marcus, Jeremiah, Abigail, and Sarah, were found in or nearby the vehicle. And at the time, Marcus was 19, so he was a legal adult, but the other ones, most of them were barely even 15. Let alone Sierra was not even a teenager. Were found, like I said, in or nearby the vehicle, which landed upside down on a Pacific Ocean beach. At the time of the article of this being written, I guess, the body of Devontae, who was 15 at the time, has not even been found yet, but as of April 3rd, 2019, the Superior Court judge ruled that Devontae was in the vehicle at the time of the crash, and a death certificate was signed on April 3rd as well. Authorities found that the SUV had been initially driven off the edge of the cliff. The car had a black box that recorded parameters of the drive and fall. A 14-member coroner's judge unanimously ruled the case as a murder-suicide. The inquest was called to determine cause of death, but not any responsibility in the civil or criminal fields. The California Highway Patrol emailed Glamour magazine stating that criminal prosecution was not possible due to the deaths of any responsible parties. Toxicology results showed at the time of the crash, Jennifer Hart was over the legal limit to drink, or to drive after drinking, I should say. The toxicology test also found that Sarah and two of their children had diphenhydramine, sorry if I mispronounced that, in their systems. Also, before the crash, Sarah Hart made Google searches inquiring about Benadryl, no-kill shelters and the nature of drowning. Andrew Thien of the Oregonian stated that previous child abuse allegations were a common element with family suicide and murder. In Huron, Jennifer Hart's family planned a memorial service, but the relative stated that the event did not occur. And just to throw this out there, I would have never even thought of holding a memorial service for her or even Sarah. I would only have held one for their kids. So it's a close court case as well, and there's records that were released that are unclassified to the public. But let's see. Let's go to this drug. So it's a drug that's mainly used to treat allergies. It could also be used for insomnia, symptoms of the common cold, tremor and Parkinsonism, and nausea. It is used by mouth, injected into a vein, injection into a muscle, or applied to the skin. The maximal effect is typically around 2 hours after a dose, and effects can last up to 7 hours. It is not recommended in young children to be used with. So, you know, it's possible that whether or not they were given legal dose, they were given too much. That's what I'm going to say on that. But let's try to find what we need to with this. So when I find this, I'll be back. By the way, you know, if you haven't, by the way, as I am looking through, trying to find this, if you have a true crime craving, no matter how morbid you like, this is the podcast for you. No, this is me trying to profit off of this, you know, because I already do that. But, you know, like I said, you want less known cases of crime, true crime and whatnot, things that stand out to the podcast, because we try not to go into the popular stuff that's already been done. You know, yeah, we went into the Zodiac, we're going to go into another popular one, but most of the time we don't go into popular ones. But like I said, just check out our podcast, subscribe, or follow us, I should say. And like I said, again, I'm going to find this autopsy, and from there we are going to read it the best that we can, because I guarantee you it's going to be written very doctory, very messy, handwriting that doctors can only read. So I've actually been able to find it, finally, besides the computer issues that I've been having. Anyhow, this is about the entire family, and whether or not we get into the entire thing, it's 8 pages long, but we'll try within the next 25-ish minutes. So this is actually about Jennifer Hart. This is from autopsyfiles.org, and we are not sponsored by them, but if you want to go check out other autopsy files like Tupac or Kurt Cobain or Heath Ledger or even not celebrities, you can, as long as they have it on there. Otherwise, let's just get into this so we don't waste any more time. But once again, this is about Jennifer Hart. She was 38 at the time, And the day of the autopsy was March 29th of 2018, and approximately 10:20 hours. So this is going to go into the information about the investigation. We will kind of, like I said with the last one, we will do what we need to with this and read what we need to. According to the investigative information, Jennifer was found unresponsive off a cliff on March 27th of 2018 at 16:45 hours. The sheriff's office responded to a fatal traffic accident located at the area of Juan Creek Bridge of Westport. The accident occurred on a large dirt torn out located west of Highway 1 on the south side of the Juan Creek Bridge. The vehicle was located on the shoreline approximately 140 feet down from the Vista View's cliffside. The vehicle was positioned on its roof. It sustained significant damage and the roof had subsequently collapsed. A personnel from the California Highway Patrol, Westport Volunteer Fire Department, Fort Bragg Fire Department, and CAL FIRE were on the scene to assist. In total, there was a total of 5 decedents found during the initial recovery. 2 were inside the vehicle, and the remaining 3 were located in the vicinity of the vehicle. The driver of the vehicle was subsequently identified once again as Jennifer, and the front seat passenger as Sarah. And obviously the children that were found. The witnesses observed pretty much the car go off, but witnesses just were multiple them, whether they were patrolmen or not. The preliminary examination concluded as the body is received wrapped in white plastic sheet, secured in a red plastic pouch on a preparatory table at Everso Mortuary, Ukiah, California. The pouch is inscribed with Jennifer, Jane Doe number 2. When first viewed at cross examination, the decedent is clad in a gray flannel hoodie sweatshirt, a black and white multi-patterned leggings, a yellow t-shirt, pink panties, a black sock on the left foot, and loose gray left shoe, all of which were returned with the body. The external examination concludes with the body is that of a well-developed, well-nourished adult, white female, whose appearance is consistent with the reported given age of 38. The head is symmetric. It also received multiple injuries, traumatic injuries specifically, that as such, as it will be described later, but the scalp is intact, covered with hair. Once again, when people die, their face is pale. But let's go into the injuries part, so let me skim through what I need to. So the face is pale, normally formed symmetric, and with multiple cutaneous injuries, including deep abrasions and lacerations on the right side of the face that will be described below. The facial bones are intact by Talpachion, and I know that I didn't mispronounce that. But the nasal bones are fractured with a torn septum. The eyelid is closed in the left eye and open in the right eye, but both are intact with cutaneous injuries that will be described below. The conjunctiva are cloudy with pedicle hemorrhages, pallor, or ectrias, I mean, that's what I meant to say. The sclerae, which I know that I did probably mispronounce, are white and the corneas are cloudy. The irides are brown and the pupils are equally dilated at 7 millimeters. Linus also had traumatic injuries, but at the time of receiving the body, it was still symmetric. The nares are unobstructed. The lips are normally formed. The mouth has native dentition and good repair, characterized by the absence of caries. The remaining oral mucosa is tan, moist, and unremarkable, without visible injury or palpable lesion or lesion. The mandible, which once again is the lower half of the jaw, has been fractured. The frenula are intact. The external ears are normally formed, symmetric, and unremarkable, without damage or injury or drainage. The bilateral earlobe creases are also there. On the right earlobe is pierced, the left one is also pierced, both at one time. Now, in short, let's just summarize what we kind of talked about really fast. So pretty much went over the injuries. Yes, I could describe every body part to you, you know, but typically majority of what it talked about was the face. You know, it didn't really talk about below the face, which we are going to get into, but it talked about how the eyes looked dead, the face dead, you know, the injuries are present, you know. That's pretty much what it was describing, what the injuries were, how the face looked, how the cornea and the eyes looked, and, you know, if anything seemed out of place with certain things. So let's go to the neck. There wasn't any visible injury or lesion. The trachea is palpable in the midline, symmetric and unremarkable. The breasts are small sized, and I'm not going to describe all that, but they weren't injured. On the chest, it's normally formed, symmetric, and it was with continuous injuries. The abdomen is soft, flat, and tympanic to percussion with continuous injuries. The back didn't have any injuries. A traumatic external genitalia are those of a normally developed adult female. It doesn't really say that it was anything down there was injured, which isn't really actually important. But just reading what it says, the upper extremities are normally formed, symmetric, and unremarkable with continuous injuries in the left arm. Both hands are wrinkled. Don't know what that exactly means. Maybe it means like from the rollover, you know, her hands jammed into her wrist or whatever, but it's not really specific. There are no needle punctures or track marks. Also, no ventral wrist scars. The fingernails are clean, trimmed. Okay. All of that. Lower extremities are normally formed, symmetric, and unremarkable with continuous injuries that will be described below. And the lower extremities are free of edema. The toenails are clean, trim, and short. There were no scars of surgical kind, no tattoos identified. Now let's go into, I know I'm going a little bit fast, but like I said, I could describe in an independent episode of all of these great medical terms. But I'm not going to in this episode, at least, due to the fact of our time. And, you know, like I said, we can make a whole episode of that stuff. So let's go into the postmortem changes. The body is well preserved, cold, It had been refrigerated, but it has not been embalmed. The rigor mortis is absent in the jaw extremities. Livor mortis is paint purple fixed and in a posterior distribution. Like I said, it goes into the extensive details of the injury. She had a lot of them all over her body. I honestly, if she didn't, I probably think she would either more likely be alive. But it goes into all of the evidence of injuries that talks about the continuous injuries. You know, whether it was her forehead, eyebrow, wrist, arm, and all the other body parts. Like I said, I can make a whole nother episode on. The eternal extermination just goes into like the fat and the abdomen, including the abdominal cavity and how much blood it contains still. Also goes, it just pretty much talks about the inside of the body in short and all of that. Her neck was dissected in a layer by layer method after the thoracoabdominal and cranial contents are removed. The superficial and deep muscles of the neck are firm, red brown, intact, and unremarkable without hemorrhage or laceration. And it looks like her neck was pretty much good. Her cardiovascular system, despite probably any blood loss, looks good as I quickly skimmed over it. Her lungs seemed normal with the respiratory system. Let's see. But several lacerations were present on the lungs, on the right upper hand and right lower lobes of the lung. The lungs also had anthracotic pigment and parenchyma, hemorrhage is what I try to say. Infarct, tumor, gross fibrous or enlargement of air spaces. The tracheobronchial tree has pink, tan, and unremarkable mucosa, and is patent without intraluminal obstructive lesion. The pulmonary vessels are patent and have a yellow tan, smooth intima, without thromboembole. Like I said, I would pronounce some of these words wrong, so. It also goes into a lot of the other systems, like thyroids and spleens and all that, which we don't really have time for to read. And a lot of it looked like wasn't actually damaged, or very little damage, as to say. Let's see. There was a cervical spinal column, though, that was present of cervical fracture of the third cervical body, along with the focal hemorrhage. That was on, I guess, the skeletal muscle, it looks like. The head and central nervous systems did sustain right frontal and bilateral occipital subcutaneous hemorrhage, and left side more than the right, though. It goes into the hemorrhage. The remaining of the spinal cord was not examined. Like I said, I'm going through a lot. And you gotta remember, A lot of this I can describe in another episode in detail, meaning that if you want me to define anything, go let me know on Facebook. Once again, After Dark Coast to Coast, their Facebook page. And I can make a whole nother episode, probably a whole nother series maybe, about that. But that's pretty much the conclusion of the autopsy. Like I said, I did go through a lot, very, very scammy-ish. Not just because we are low on time, but it's because, like I said, a lot of it was just minor injuries. You know, whenever you get into the body, you know, because obviously you can look on any body and see, oh, you know, this person's bleeding out. This person had a cut, you know, on right above the left eyebrow, or your nose is broken. You know, the obvious outside things you can see. But a lot of what was inside was pretty much hemorrhages to no hemorrhages, to no damage to some damage. And the damage, like I said, was more so of hemorrhage than anything else. Once again, it did not include, you know, the toxicology, but we did go over that. But the cause of death, besides the car going off a 100-foot cliff, was multiple blunt force injuries, especially neck and right chest. And I guess it happened in seconds, you know, from the force of impact, and then they just pretty much died. You know, or she pretty much died like that. I don't know if anybody survived and it just died. But it did not include the toxicology, but once again, Sarah was well over the legal limit to drink and drive. So I don't know if Sarah was, but you know, Sarah was also responsible and even considered killing her own children as well. So she just went along with it, I guess. I also had a questionable search history. Anyhow, if you liked this episode and liked any other episode that you've recently heard but not have followed us, go follow us right now. You know, it's just that simple. Anyhow, stay tuned for tomorrow's episodes. Yes, they are. Well, at least, let's see. Let me go back to my list really fast, because my list is going to get out a lot. Yeah, our next episodes are going to be tomorrow and then Wednesday. Tomorrow we are going back into Long Haul Killers. But yeah, so, and then we will be caught up, and hopefully, like I said, I should be recording more episodes on my days off and in between work and life, so we can at least stay caught up, if not at most a couple weeks at a time or so. Want to try to get the rest of this month at least done. But without further ado, stay tuned for tomorrow's episode of Long Haul Killers. See you next time.